Hey, good morning. This is Vicky, Gypsy Clipper. It's 7:30, and it is Wednesday, May 2nd, and it says it's 66 degrees in Wanaco. It's actually overcast, and I'm still in bed. Yesterday was beautiful, absolutely beautiful, and, oh my gosh, sorry, we apparently are in for a couple of days of storms. So I was trying to figure out what I was going to get accomplished today, and I'm going to get everything put away, all my tools, and my little workshop put back together, because I've been working. I might try to get some, Chris has got a screen door that needs, I need to fix. There's a bunch of little projects I'd like to do before I hit the road, but all her little projects take away from my projects, but, you know, it's how it works. You know, I'm sure everybody's familiar with that, but I am dealing with ticks. Oh, my gosh, it's crazy, you know, and that's, I remember that from last year, too. I think that's kind of a regular occurrence. So you got to do the once over, you know, on yourself and the dogs and, you know, and check everything out for ticks, but in the morning, when I go outside with the dogs, it's pretty cool because we have a 10-acre square here, including, you know, my old property and this property. So this is an acre and a half, and Mike's behind us, the douchebag, is 8.5, so it's 10 acres, and it's a square on a county road. Well, not even a county road. I guess we call them township roads here. And you have like the hard road, which would be a county road, and then you've got these feeder roads off of it. And they would have been farm roads. They would have been surrounding. They're 1 acre exactly, or 1 mile exactly. And they run east and west. There are no diagonal roads. The only diagonal roads are state highways, but county roads run, you know, east and west and north and south, you know, it's on the square. And then the field roads run a mile in between each one of them. And then that mile square is divided into different field plots. So the field roads between them would go like a mile, you know, and they're opposite direction of what you'd think they'd be. They're like I live on 900 north, and which would be a 1 mile, you know, and the next one would be 800, you know, 700 that way, and the other one would be 900, 1,000, you know, if you go the other way. Well, my the road in front of my place runs north and south, and so my bus faces directly east, and my the back of my bus faces directly west. Well, the wind now comes out of the west, which is nice, because apparently the back of the bus is better sealed, you know, because the front has two doors, you know, and both doors are fine, but, you know, one is a, you know, bus door, so it splits in the middle, and it's just got rubber gaskets around it, so it's definitely not, you know, airtight by any stretch. It's not like, you know, an airlock on a, you know, on a plane or anything like that. So with the wind coming out of the west, it's not a big deal. You can't, it doesn't really bother you, but when it comes out of the east, which it never does, oh, it's the strangest thing. The wind never comes out of the east here. It either comes out of the north, comes out of the south, or comes out of the west. And with the weather changing, I feel it's coming, you know, from the north, which means it's going to be a little chillier, which means we're going to have some thunderstorms. So I need to get everything battened down, and apparently we've got quite a bit of wind coming. And it's funny because the last 2 days have been somewhat windy, but it's been directly out of the south. Well, it's actually been southwest, so it kind of goes diagonally across the bus, which is beautiful for a campfire. So I've had a campfire every night, so it draws the wind away. But country living, it's the funniest thing. If you've never done it, it's I've lived in the country all my life, you know. I mean, I've had animals all my life since I was little. Obviously, I had horses since I was, I think it was 5, you know what I mean? Or no, I'd have to do the math again. I'm sure I figured it out, but I was born in 66 and bought the horses in 73. So I guess I was seven. So my sister would have been five. So five and seven. So I've had animals all my life. Right now I have just the two dogs. But Chris has two ponies, three outside dogs, and then she's got a couple of inside little dogs like Chihuahuas or something. I don't know what they're. They're mean and they don't like me. That's what I know. But so I've been doing like farm things, you know. So I've been taking care of, you know, like getting the pasture line around for the ponies and stuff. She works full time, so she doesn't have time to do this kind of stuff. So I thought before I hit the road, I was going to try to get as much done as I possibly could. And then I've got to work on my own bus because I don't want to, you know, just throw everything in here and take off down the road. Because it just beats the shit out of, you know. But we have the three outside dogs. And they are, one's a Great Pyrenees and one's like a Great Dane Labrador cross. And the other one's like a, some kind of beagle something. I don't know, some kind of a hunting dog. And they're all good dogs. The Great Pyrenees is an asshole, but it kind of comes with, you know, how we ended up getting him. Somebody had showed up, and somebody Tom had met. He had spent some time in the hospital, and this guy gave him a ride home from Springfield, and it was when we didn't have a car. So this is years ago, long time ago, and so this guy shows up, and they're kind of rednecks, you know, like the rest of us. And he shows up, and with this Great Pyrenees in the back of his truck, and I think he said he was gonna shoot it. Well, I'm sure that's what he said he was gonna do. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, shock anybody, but you know, people do that. And we were like, you know, we had another Great Pyrenees, so we're like, yeah, we'll take him, you know, and it worked out perfect for us, you know, because, you know, they work better in pairs, especially out here. We have coyotes, something fierce, you know, and you know, you just do, you know, out in the country, that's what they do. And so we get this dog, and he's horrible. I mean, he won't stay in a fence. I mean, he wanders all night, you know, barks, you know, but that's what they do. I mean, that's his job. And so you just kind of get used to it. Well, Chris doesn't have livestock, but he still does his job. So, and you can hear him. I mean, he wanders miles. I mean, you can hear him 2 miles away, you know, so it's just what he does. Well, they brought home a groundhog, you know, dead, obviously, and left it out in the road, and we get no traffic, so it's not like, you know, anybody else was going to come along and, you know, haul it off or do something with it. So this has been 80 degrees, so needless to say, I had to do something with the groundhog, and I gotta tell you, that stuff is just beyond me. And I, you know, and it's, you know, you can't bury it because the dogs will dig it back up, so you're kind of stuck. So I had to dispose of it in what we call a redneck incinerator, and I won't go into details, but made last night's bonfire a little unpleasant because apparently my crematorium is not nearly as effective as other people. I hear so many horrible stories. No one tells you about life in the country, and nobody tells you about dealing with death in the country. It's not pleasant. It's complicated. And I have another van dwelling friend, and he's just every time I the shock value of a conversation is, and I don't mean it, it's just, you know, he's like, well, how did your day go? And I'm like, oh, you know, and then so you go into the story about, you know, the groundhog crematorium, and, you know, and I, you know, have to pepper it with, you know, some redneck, you know, cooking tips and things like that. And it's so funny. I mean, it's just the way you look at things in country living is so much different than the way you look at it in city living. And it's hard, you know, for people in the city to understand, you know, how it works out here. And you try not to mention it, but I had a really good friend. Her name was Andrea. And she and her husband, they had lots of money, you know, lots and lots of money. And he had lots and lots of time. And so he had it in his head that they were going to be sustainable farmers, you know, and they were going to homeschool their kids and everything. And so he had a barn dismantled in Pennsylvania and brought out here on a train. And then they had it erected on their property. And they, beautiful place just outside of Springfield, just absolutely beautiful. I mean, phenomenal. I mean, they had, I believe they were featured in a couple of magazines and things like that. And they had, you know, 5 kids, and she was homeschooling and, you know, and milking goats and raising chickens, doing the whole thing. I mean, it's very impressive. Money was no object, so, and, you know, but she wasn't, like, she didn't come from money. Neither of them came from money. I mean, and so they kind of did everything kind of like the, you know, pragmatic kind of homestead. It's a very impressive setup. But one thing that she had said is, you know, because they had done the pastured chickens, you know, and there's a guy, his name is Joel Salatin, and he's written books, you know, $25,000 on pastured poultry or some shit like that. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's, we've all done it. I mean, I've raised hundreds of chickens, you know, using his methods, and, you know, it is profitable. It's quite profitable, but it's labor intensive, you know, seriously labor intensive. And one of the things that you have to deal with is hundreds of baby chicks, and they come to you in the mail. I don't know if anybody's, I mean, I'm sure you've got the internet and you're probably aware of how it works, but, you know, you get day old chickens, you know, as soon as they're hatched, you know, they send them to you. And you know, and lots of times you get just like a straight run, which is males and females, and so you get 50%. It usually is 50%, 50-50, and you raise them all together. You raise them for food, obviously. So they grow at, you know, phenomenal speeds. You know, 8 weeks, you know, start to finish, and when you get them, they're quite hardy little guys. But the problem is to do it, you have to get them early in the season. Well, we obviously don't have a very good season here. Well, and I remember she had tried to have her first birds for Memorial Day weekend, and this is so bad because that means you have to order them 8 weeks prior. Well, you've listened to me. You know how the weather's been up until this last week. So you're trying to raise these little chickens, and they're just disgusting. You know, I mean, that they all they do is eat and shit. I mean, that's their job. You know, and so. They don't have a lot of feathers, you know, because, you know, that makes it that much more expensive to have them processed. Because you have to have them processed at a USDA facility if you want to sell them commercially. And we only have one USDA facility, and it's here in Arthur, Illinois. And it's quite impressive. They do 1,700 birds in a day. And that's from, they start at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they end at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And you drop your birds off in the morning, and then you pick them up. And they are absolutely packaged, ready to go to the store. I mean, they are already cooled off. They are packaged exactly like you see them in the grocery store. And it's very impressive. And I think the entire operation, I think there's 16 people working. And it's so impressive. It's and you get to watch it. You know, I mean, it's all behind glass, so you can actually see it. But like Andrea said, that nobody tells you how to deal with the death. And she wanted to write a book, 101 Ways to Kill a Chicken, and they were so bad. I mean, and it was, they had done everything right, but, you know, there's so many mishaps, you know, and especially if your crew is a couple of your own kids, you know, all of them are, you know, you have four boys between the ages of 5 and 9 are your work crew. So needless to say, there's a lot of mistakes. But yeah, that was, I got to thinking about that yesterday when I was dealing with the groundhog. And because I hadn't had to do any of that stuff in years. You know, I hadn't had to figure out, you know, how to dispose of, you know, something like that. And it was just, oh my God, brought back memories. And I don't want to do that again. I really don't. I'm capable, you know, whatever, but there are a million people that would can do it. And I'm perfectly happy to let them do it. And, you know, and the same being said about, oh my gosh, they're doing, I'm doing all this, these little construction projects for her, and that's what I did in Houston. That's, you know, and I'd find these little old ladies, you know, I mean, the single little old ladies that needed, you know, trustworthy help, you know, and that's what I do. And It's so funny. I'd forgotten. You know, because even I mean, she's still my best friend. You know, she's still wonderful, but she's still, you know, you still have to follow instructions. You know, I mean, and she's really good about taking, you know, my suggestions. You know, about, you know, what works, and it reminds me that, you know, that it is a service industry, you know, and I love doing it. I mean, I really do. I mean, because she definitely needs the help, but I would so much rather build furniture. And so I can't wait to get my shop finished in here so I can just get on the road and just kind of work for myself again, you know, instead of doing these kind of things. But, you know the deal. But I'm going to let you go and just relax and have my tea and... take the dogs for their walk. Like I say, it's 2 miles. We walk all the way around Mike's and here, you know, and so 2 miles, take the dogs for a walk, and then come back and get some projects done. But you guys have a great day, and we'll talk soon. Oh, come on. Yeah, hey, this is Vicky, Gypsy Clipper, and it's noon. We went to town, and you know, Chris needed ice and fixings for tea, and so we went out to breakfast. And it's so expensive to eat out. I don't know how people do, and I'm sure it's not this expensive other places. You know, because but it cost us like $22 for the two of us just to have breakfast. No booze, no nothing. Just breakfast. Coffee, and she had iced tea, and I had a special breakfast horseshoe, which is, I don't think you get a breakfast pony shoe, and I don't know if they have horseshoes or pony shoes in any other state. It's an Illinois thing, and what it is it's a 2 pieces of Texas toast with French fries on it, and for breakfast, you have sausage or ham or bacon. Well, I had sausage, and then it's Texas toast, French fries, sausage, and scrambled eggs, and then it's covered with either melted cheese or sausage gravy. So you definitely don't eat that if you're on a diet. But I walked my 2 miles this morning, so I thought, I can handle it, and it was really good. And Chris got some kind of like skillet or something with like mushrooms and stuff like that. It was good. And big news is that Country Kitchen, now they are serving beer, so you can get Stag Light. What was that? Natural Light, whatever that is, and Bud Light. So, you know, big steps here in Hooterville. Normally there's only I think there's only one other restaurant that serves. Oh, two. There's a Mexican restaurant in town which serves excellent food, but they serve beer. And then there's a pizza joint that serves beer, but the rest of them, no, not so much. I don't think we even have. I don't even know if we have any other. You know, oh, we have a pizza place on the square, something. I don't know. We don't eat out that much. I'm saving my money to eat out, you know, someplace different, not here. But I mean, it was good. I mean, it was real good. And then of course went to Walmart and. Now lettuce is no longer on the no fly list. You hadn't been able to buy any salad here at all since the romaine E. coli scare. I mean, no salad, nothing, not a speck of salad, which is fine because apparently it's not like they make a ton of money on salad here. I looked at Brazil nuts. 5 ounces of Brazil nuts, raw Brazil nuts, is $5, $4.98. 5 ounces, $4.98. It's like you can't. And then those pot stickers that I bought last week, they were marked down to $1.73 because nobody eats them. Regular price, $4.86, and that's for like 20 pot stickers. I mean, that's crazy. But you know, that's my rant. I mean, but it's just really expensive here. And the reason it's so expensive is because you're kind of a captive audience. They only, you know, you can't go anywhere. Most of the people that shop at Walmart in this town don't drive. They don't leave town. We have had the same population, 11,104, since I was a kid. So that's 30 years. I don't know if they just quit counting or what. It doesn't make any sense. But, you know, Who knows? That's one of those things I just don't get. It is, like I said, noon on Wednesday, May 2nd, and the temperature is, let me see. I can't tell. I think it's probably 80 degrees. It's beautiful. I mean, absolutely beautiful. But that's my noon update. Definitely too breezy for a fire. And tonight's supposed to be storming. You know, we've got rain coming in. So I'm just going to sit out here and enjoy the birds. It's Chris's day off, so I'm just going to do a little bit of construction for her when she gets up from her nap. But other than that, it's just a quiet day. I'm just enjoying sitting out here with the birds. But you guys have a great day. Yeah, hey, this is Vicky, Gypsy Clipper. And I got a call from one of my millions of listeners. And he had a question about farming. And he said he was interested in, you know, providing his own food and whatever. And it got me to thinking, I don't know, I probably have some insights that maybe somebody might be interested in. But, you know, what we did, I started out just raising food for myself, you know, and myself and my ex-husband, you know. And I mean, I've gardened forever. I mean, we've been driving a truck, you know, the whole time I was driving a truck. I mean, and I would have a garden going while we were gone, and because we were home every weekend, so I could get home on the weekends and do whatever it was that I needed. And in my original house, you know, here on the original acre and a half, because like I said, I had an 8.5 acres, but we only gardened on an acre and a half and lived on an acre and a half. We didn't do anything on the 8.5 acres, and it was when we moved back to the back 8.5 acres is when I started producing enough to sell, and I did it traditional, you know, with like row crops, you know, and I grew things. Well, originally how it started was I had raised beds alongside the house, and we had built them out of just standard 2x6 lumber, you know, stacked too high. You know, in the 4x8 foot beds. And I had probably 10 of those. I mean, originally I had started out with like a couple, and then we added to them. So I didn't start out with them like they were. And so then we got big. My ex-husband, you know, go big or go home was his motto. And so he got a 6 foot tiller. And he tilled me, like I said, a 100x200 foot garden, you know, just for me by myself. And his dad had done the same thing for his mom. And that's just how they did things, was just big. And I really enjoyed the raised bed gardening because I was into the square foot gardening. And that's kind of how I garden. I kind of am, you know, kind of OCD in my gardening. And I was more into the, Elliot Coleman was my mentor, you know, through his books and whatever, and he had a formula for how much he needed to make per square foot, or square foot is how he figured it out, and it was just amazing, you know, how he did it. And they said there was nothing new in gardening, and he was right. I mean, there really isn't, but there are so many innovations that make it, you know, such an easier setup now. But Jean-Martin Fortier is another one, and he's Canadian, French-Canadian, I believe. But he has a book out. Either he or Elliot Coleman, and Joel Salatin, probably the three gurus of small-scale farming, you know, and farming for profit. And I think all three of those. Then there's Curtis Stone also, but he's just rehashing, you know, the three gurus, you know what I mean? And most of what you see on YouTube and whatever are from the three gurus. And I'm not even saying that Jean-Martin Fortier is a guru. I think he's taken what Elliot Coleman had originally put out there
kind of customized it into more of a into a smaller scale than what Elliot Coleman had done. And all three of those pioneers are really, if you're interested at all, and then you just put your own spin on it. Because I, even my partner Tom, who is of the go big, go home mentality, I mean, he even had decided that we did as well intensively gardening the raised beds as we had done on the larger scale. And because what you do is you are more likely to be able to custom grow things for your customers. And that's kind of what we did. We had grown in every day. We had grown for farmers markets, and we had gotten to the point that we had done 7 markets in a week. I mean, we were burning the candle at both ends and killing ourselves, but we made phenomenal money. I mean, and you know, and then we'd just be exhausted. So it took its toll on us. So that if I were to do it again, I definitely wouldn't do it that way. What ended up working the best for us. And I think it's a great market, and it kind of goes along with Joel Salatin, or even Elliot Coleman, because Elliot Coleman had delivered to more specialty markets, so that's how he was able to sell at a higher price, Joel Salatin had a buyer's club, so people would pay a membership fee, and then he would set up delivery dates at certain people's homes and would offer them produce in exchange for the ability to leave his produce there, you know, and sometimes that's what he would do. It would just be a drop off, and then people would come pick it up, and it was kind of the honor system, but you paid prepaid, and you just went there and picked it up. So it was a really efficient system, and then that system worked wonderfully, and not quite sure how Jean-Martin Fortier does it. I haven't read his book. I just kind of skipped through it. But it's exactly what is said by Elliot Coleman, except he, well, and what's really nice is Elliot Coleman pioneered some of the equipment, the small scale equipment. I have a friend here in Illinois, and he also would go to the farmers markets, and he was probably the most popular booth at the farmers markets, and it was very impressive how he how his clientele were just super loyal. I mean, he was just putting out a great product for a great price, and he even had discovered that he was happier doing direct marketing from his farm. But you had to kind of train customers, because they would think that they could just show up anytime, and it really doesn't. It didn't work that way. It's inconvenient. The way the Amish do it here, they set out farm stands at the end of their driveway, and lots of times the kids would be out there manning them, you know, or they would come out whenever they had customers, but they were open all the time, you know, except on Sundays, of course, because of their religion. But they also had a great setup. They would train their customers, basically. But what worked the best for us is we would go out and we would plant all the things that we loved and we knew that customers liked. And we would plant them. And in the morning, we would go out and harvest everything that was ripe. And we would photograph it all, and then we would divide it into bags. And we just used Walmart sacks. And we would post, you know, the boxes, and we would post that they were available, you know, what was available that day. And at the end of the day, people could either come out to the farm, or we would take them to town and drop them off. And taking them to town and dropping them off was better for us, because it enabled us to go to town every day, which is something we did anyway, because, you know, being smokers, you know, and drinkers, that was, you go buy a 12-pack of beer and a pack of smokes. That was, you know, what you did every day, and that's how you got off the farm, you know, from being, you know, made totally insane just staying here 24/7. But I mean, there are just so many different ways, and if it's something that, you know, my customers or my listeners are interested in, I recommend it wholeheartedly. The problem is, and why we couldn't continue to do it anymore, is because my overhead was too high. I owed too much on my farm. I mean, I had taken on some bad debt and, you know, taken on some family debt and then made some bad investments and bad choices myself, you know, so we couldn't afford to keep the place. So it was just a matter of time, you know, and that's how we got started in the drugs. And because we were just waiting, you know, just waiting for them to come kick us off the property, basically. And it obviously was, you know, some of our own problems, but yeah, I mean, as far as a good living, I mean, but first of all, what I am aiming towards in my setup now is I am aiming towards taking my bus and buying a small tract of land. I honestly would like to buy it large enough to have others come live there. And I don't want to charge anything. I just want it to be free. And I want people to contribute, you know, to the market. There's a community in Tennessee. It's called The Farm. And they've been, you know, in existence since the 70s, and it started out something other than what it is. It was communal living, and I don't know how 70s it was. I don't know, you know, what it all entailed, but it was impressive, the fact that it still is in existence, and I'd like to model something after that, but I don't have you know, bottomless pockets. So it's something. It's just a work in progress. But I think it's a viable living. I mean, and especially if you had volunteer help. I mean the problem here is we tried counting on relatives and, you know, and some of our customers to come out and work. The problem was is people just aren't that reliable, and it gets hot, and it's hard work. I mean, if you could get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and get out there and do all your work before noon, I mean, then you're doing perfectly, and that's how we do it. The problem with it is our farmers markets go till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 1 o'clock it's hot. I mean, it's seriously hot here, and your produce is definitely, you know, worse for the wear, and they kind of count on you just giving away your produce at the end of the day, and that's just not profitable. You can't do it. I mean, and you know, the food banks would come around and everything, and I mean, I understand, you know, that people need to eat, but it isn't off of a custom farmer's back, because it's just not possible. I mean, you can't make a living giving away your food. I mean, you just can't. If it doesn't sell that day, you have to take it home and process it into something else, more profitable. And they have made that possible now, because they have what they call the Cottage Food Act, and you can sell jams, jellies, salsas, you know, pickles, that kind of stuff. So there is no waste. So finally, you know, here in Illinois, it's profitable, except for the fact, like I said, the farmers markets run too late. You know, I mean, they start early. They start in mid-May, I believe, you know, like the second week of May, which is too early here. I mean, because it's just put such a horrible stress on a producer. I mean, and people don't want spring products, which is greens. I mean, in the spring you get spinach, you get kale, you get those kind of things, because those things can deal with the weather, you know, I mean, the fluctuations in the weather, and you can't really afford a greenhouse. I mean, you can't afford to heat it. I mean, so here, I mean, the weather is, you know, the climate is ideal, but it's just the clientele is just not there, you know. I mean, and it's just this. The dynamics here are just weird. People don't appreciate it, because they can grow it themselves, and the things that they grow, it's crazy. We had a customer come to one of our farmers markets and wanted to know when the avocados would be ready, and it's like, we don't have those. And then you'd get custard. The big product here is corn and sweet corn, which is so funny, because I'm surrounded by fields, and like this year is corn, and so it does not produce ears until the end of July and August, but you have customers coming in May wanting to know when your sweet corn is going to be ready, and it's like, I don't know any secrets that these guys in the fields don't know. You know, I don't know any, you know, I mean, if they can't get it to grow any sooner than I, you know, then they do, and they have bottomless pockets. And these guys do have bottomless pockets. You have to understand that a conventional farmer, corn, beans, you know, around here, I mean, they're subsidized. So they are already working. There's a great movie out there, and it's probably difficult to find, but I believe it's called King Corn. And it is, it's not like Food Inc. or any of those that's just going to turn you off of, you know, slaughtered beef or anything. I mean, it isn't anything like that, but it gives you an idea of why corn and bean farming is detrimental to the economy. It's called King Corn, and it's such a good movie. I recommend it to anybody. But I've taken up 15 minutes of your time, and I'll let you go. But have a great day. Yeah, hey, this is Vicky, Gypsy Clipper. And I am watching a squirrel. Oh, I scared him. Well, apparently didn't scare him that bad. But I've been sitting here for the last 10 minutes. Oh my gosh, there's two of them. Huh, funny. I've been watching a squirrel. And he's like 5 feet away from me. And I have pine needles out here, and I throw bird seed and tortilla chips and whatever else I have. Oh, he's so cute. They're so sweet. He's like laying in the tree right now. And I've got there's a branch like 3 feet off the ground. And oh, I got three squirrels. Holy shit. I'm right here within 10 feet away. There's like one. I got a tree that's about 10 feet away. I've got another tree that's about 15 feet away, and then I've got a patch of grass that is about 20 feet away, and they're just all squirrels all around. And it's so funny, because they dig these little holes looking for, I guess, seeds that go through the pine needles, and it's so cool, because they use their little paws, and they pull back the pine straw, and they look for something, and then they put the pine straw back. It's so funny. I've got this, there's the one that's in the lowest branch, and it's about, like I said, 15 feet away or so, maybe a little bit further. I don't know, I need to tape measure it. He's laying with his butt up against the tree, and his tail is kind of like up against the tree. But he's got his little front paws just hanging down on both sides of the branches. And his little back leg is just hanging down. It's so cute. And if I had a camera worth a shit, I could show you. And then this one here to the left must be a baby. It's really little. And it's over here. And it's right by my bus. It's like the branch. Oh, my gosh. He's so cute. He's just a little guy. He's just tiny. He must be like last year's. They say they stay in the nest for a year, and he's so brave. It's so funny. He's like 4 feet away from the top of my bus. I hear them on the bus sometimes, but it's so sweet. This is one. They must be like mommy and daddy, and this must be a baby, but it's so tiny. It's so cute. And he's not afraid of me at all. He's less than 10 feet away, just playing in the tree. And his tail is so little. And I think that's kind of how you can, and he's just tiny. Look at him. He's always playing with his tail. And he's definitely running back and forth. Oh my gosh, he's so cute. I've never seen a baby squirrel. And he's just looking at me like, what are you doing? He's not scared at all. And his mommy's like right over there. He's like right over, he goes towards my bus, and he turns around, and he backs up, and then he goes towards the bus. And now he leaps on the tree. Now he's coming right over the top of me. Look at that. That is so sweet. He's not 4 feet away from me, and he's hanging onto a branch with his little paws, and he's pulling it towards him. It's so cute. And his mom's just laying over there in the tree with her little feet just hanging off the side of the branch. And the branch is like squirrel size. It's just like perfect. And now he's grooming himself. Oh my God, it's so cute. And he's so tiny. It's funny. He's pulling the branch towards him with his little paws. And I don't know what he's doing with it. He's I guess he's chewing on it. Yeah, and he's kind of playing with it. That's so cute. And he's holding it. Oh, he just rubbed on it. He just used it to scratch his head. Oh, that's so cute. Now he's like right over the top of me. Turn around, he ran back to the tree. He only like, that's so cute. I have never, ever been this close to a baby squirrel. And I didn't even see him there. I didn't even realize he was there. I was watching the one here on the ground, and he's like right over the top of me right now. And now the wind blows, and so he runs back to the tree. Oh my gosh, he's so brave. He's right, heading back to the tree and turn around and running back. And he should see, because the pine, he found something. He's hanging off the tree, eating it. I don't know what it was. He's got it in his mouth. His little feet. He's like, no, too windy. Can you hear that wind? It's crazy. Yeah, he's on the other side of the tree. I don't know. He's still got that in his mouth. That's so funny. And his mommy's just, oh my gosh, she's sleeping. Oh, she's got her little paws just hanging down. It's funny. She's got her like butt wedged up against the tree, and then her back feet are hanging down. Her front feet are hanging down. And she's just sleeping. That's so sweet. Oh no, he's doing the same thing. Oh, he's just resting on the tree right by me. Oh, he's closing his little eyes. It's like little squirrel naps. Apparently, it must be squirrel siesta. I'm gonna be quiet here and let the squirrels take their siesta. But you guys have a great day. Oh my God, they do. They put their tail right up against the tree, and their little feet hang down. They kind of use. That's so cute. And he's got his little eyes closed. Apparently, he's resting. But you guys have a great day. Yeah, hey, it's Vicky, Gypsy Clipper, and it's 3:30. I got some projects taken care of for both Chris and myself. The humidity is up to 67%, and it's overcast, so I believe we are heading in for a storm. And I think we have a chance of rain for the next 3 days, and which is fine because it's crispy dry here, and the corn hasn't popped up in the fields yet, so it definitely could use a drink. But it's beautiful. I'm sitting out here and I'm listening to some morning doves and watching the squirrels, and they're so funny. And I am listening to my neighbors shoot things, which is kind of, you know, a sound in the country. Apparently they're reloading. I have no idea what they're shooting. I mean, I know they're target practicing, but I guess today's a good day for it. And it doesn't bother me. It makes Chris insane. But I think it's kind of what happens in the country. And that's kind of one of the holdups with me finding a piece of property. Because I kind of need to go there first, because I don't want to set up in the middle of someplace that, you know, is surrounded by, you know, four-wheelers and shooting ranges. And that's what happens in the country. I mean, and you have to expect it. I mean, it's kind of why people move to the country. It's one of the huge reasons. I like I said, I do have, you know, a couple of guns, but I actually go to the gun range to practice. I used to target practice out in the country, and I discovered it's kind of annoying, so I'm not going to do it. And it's not all that effective. I'm not going to be picking people off from, you know, 100 feet away or 500 feet away or anything. I have pretty good aim, and I have, you know, made sure everything works like supposed to, and I don't ever plan on, you know, using them. So for me, it's just, you know, I think I originally got them when I first got here and I could, you know, and I know when I change residency, I'm gonna do the same thing. But I thought I'd be out of here, you know, June 1st, but it's already May 2nd, and I'm definitely not as far along as I'd hope. And there are some things that I want to be able to do to my bus, because I would like to make sure all my tires are good. I mean, they look good, but they've been sitting out here for, you know, 6 months in the sun, and I don't see any dry rot. I mean, they're fairly young, so, I mean, it's little stuff that you just kind of have to, and it's not that, I guess, because June going anywhere is kind of a weird time, you know what I mean? I mean, it's all a work in progress, you know. It's just kind of playing it by ear. Yeah, but it says it's 87 degrees, and I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, I sit in the shade, so it's you know, in like a group of trees. What is it, 12 trees, and they're big pine trees, like 30-foot pine trees, and my bus is on behind me, and so it blocks all the wind. I can't even tell it's wind. I mean, other than the fact that the trees are blowing above me, but down here, you know, when earlier when I was recording my podcast,
the wind was blowing a little bit from the west, which it does. Like I said, it never comes from the east. And right now it's coming from the west. I think it's like 17 miles an hour to the west. It says moderate 17 miles an hour. I don't know about you, but 17 doesn't seem moderate to me. It seems quite high, but you know, I guess for Arizona, that's moderate. I don't know. But I don't write the weather. And if I did, I would suck at it. I absolutely would suck at it. But it's just really nice. I'm not getting much accomplished. I like piddling. Like when Chris is home, I hate pulling out all my tools and, you know, and doing all that stuff. Because it's disruptive. And it makes her dogs bark. And she really is tired. I sit there and I see, you know, how much she struggles. I mean, she's got such a tough job. And they're talking about replacing the kitchen down there where she is, and which is wonderful. But I'm not quite sure how they're going to do it around there. And she's there 7 days a week. I mean, she works 40 hours a week. And they have to cook for right now. I think they have 62 inmates. So I mean, that's a lot. I mean, that's you know, especially, you know, for just one person, and it is, it's just one person. Each, she works 4 days a week, and she's got someone else that works 3 days a week, but they cannot find anyone else to do that job. And it's funny, because it's not a bad job. I mean, it's just, you have to just not give a fuck, because the inmates can send notes down to the kitchen, and they're usually bad. I mean, and she tries hard. They have a prescribed menu that they're supposed to cook, and it's crap. I mean, but she improvises, and the jailers are really happy she does, but her boss has been giving her a rash of shit. She's been getting a rash of shit all the way around. It's a political job, it's become political. There's a couple people in the system that are just itching to get them out. You know, it's dumb. I mean, you know, anyone that works and, you know, it works with anyone else. I mean, it's, there's so much backbiting. It's horrible. And it's worse here, you know, because, I mean, these people are, there's only so many jobs to go around. And, with the new kitchen coming in, I imagine that job looks a little bit more, appealing to people who didn't want it before. So I believe their contract is up in 2 weeks. And, right now, so they're getting a lot of flack from some of the guards, and I think there's ulterior motives. There's a couple of guards that must have something in mind as far as doing something with the feeding. It's weird. It's just crazy weird. You know what I mean? I don't know. I watch it from the outside, and it's political as usual. You know how it goes. But I guess I don't like it when my podcast isn't positive, but it's one of those things. The reason it's even like this is because have been, I don't know, it is what it is. But you guys have a great day. Thank you. Yeah, hey, this is Vicky, Gypsy Clipper, and I'm sitting out here outside. It's still beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. Can anybody tell me what that bird is? I can't see it, but I hear it all the time. It must be tiny, but it's loud. Wait. Hey, this is Vicky, Gypsy Clipper, and it's 8 o'clock on hell is it? I guess it's Wednesday, March 2nd, and I have gotten all my tools put away, and I am sitting down for a beer and enjoying the last of the sunshine, and thought I'd wrap it up, and I got no responses on that question about the bird call, and I have no idea how to find it out, but I'm going to sit out here and tomorrow and try to figure this out, and I'll let you know if I do figure it out. But I had mentioned a movie, and it's called King Korn, and it's freaking awesome. And if you look it up on YouTube, you can purchase
or rent it for $2.99. But there's also somebody who has posted it also on YouTube, and I recommend that you watch it. It's excellent. It gives you such a insight on why farming is fucked up. But you know. And it's not, I mean, why small scale, large scale commodities farming is fucked up. I mean, it's a great insight. It kind of gives you an idea why it's difficult for the small farmer to, it isn't difficult for them to make a living. It just requires a little bit more salesmanship. You have to know why it is that your prices are more than what you can. Tom had such a good argument for, you know, why his lettuce was so expensive, and he is such a good farmer, and he really you know, puts his heart and soul into his products, and you just don't, you wouldn't get E. coli from one of a small scale farmer's products, because we're not dealing with runoff from, you know, porta potties and things like that. I mean, because we care. I mean, you know exactly where your food's coming from, and that is the hardest part about being a small scale farmer, is finding the right customers. But when you do find the right customers, they're very loyal. They're definitely, you definitely feel like you want to provide them with the best. But that being said, I am going to wrap it up here, and everybody have a wonderful evening. Thank you again.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.